Welcome to the Fresnolandia podcast. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
We've got a full show for you today. We've got a community question to answer. Donnie's going to recap some of the headlines from this week. And then we're bringing another Fresnoland reporter in to talk about both the homelessness ordinance that came down from both the county and the city, as well as the state of affordable housing and housing developments in Fresno. And then at the end, we're going to share what our favorite Olympic events are this year. All right, Donnie, we got a community question this week from Instagram. What was the question?
The question was, what is up with the protected bike lane on Palm? I thought it was going to be finished, and it is not finished.
Protected bike lanes are critically important. What do we know?
So first of all, if you drive on Palm, which I drive on Palm every single day, the protected bike lane, for those of you who aren't familiar with the lingo, is the part of the bike lane that has the bollards that separate the bikes from the cars. Very important. Lots of research shows it's a lot safer. But if you go on Palm north of Shields, there's a bunch of parts where the bollards are missing. And so it's just like a normal bike lane. It's not anything special. So I asked the city, and council member Annalisa Perea got back to me pretty fast with my answer to my question. Once she got information from the city's public works department. And basically what the city said is, yeah, a lot of the bollards got damaged. They have to replace them. They have to order new parts, and it takes time to order those new parts. And so they're in the process of ordering new bollards. And once they can order them and get them in, then they can install them, and it takes time. They don't have a time frame yet, but they are on it and they are trying to fix it.
I love riding my bike, and being behind a protected bike lane, it just makes you feel so safe. I love sitting up on my seat, not touching my handlebars, and just gliding down a street. I won't do that if I'm on Blackstone between
But they are
Bullard
planning protected bike lanes on Blackstone. Did you know this?
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's
just
part
all
of,
the way down Blackstone?
I don't remember what the specific streets are, but no, there's definitely a plan to put protected bike lanes on Blackstone.
Yeah, I'm fully a believer that if you build it, they will come when it comes to bicycles.
But you need a network, and I think that's part of the problem is we have the wonderful protected lanes on Palm and on Belmont. But it's like just part of a network. And if you want to go north, the protected bike lane right now ends at Dakota. I'm not biking on Palm.
No way.
North of Dakota. No way. I am sorry.
And that just reminds me of that hilarious video that we saw of Dyer pretending. He claims he rode all the way to City Hall from his house.
Yeah.
I would like to see the full video to believe it. But even if he did, I'm sure he narrowly survived a number of close calls with how fast people drive on a lot of
this
roads.
Reminds me of my favorite Steve Brandow story, if I could share it.
Yes, please.
With our readers, Supervisor Steve Brandow, former city council member on the Fresno City Council. And I think he wouldn't mind me teasing him about this if he heard this. But anyways, there was this debate a couple of years ago when he was on the city council about whether we should put in bike lanes. I think it was on Barstow at the time. And he was very opposed to it. He didn't think that it was a good use of money. And he went out and physically counted the number of bicyclists that went by and came back to the council meeting and said, hey, look, I stood out there for, I don't know, an hour, 2 hours, and I counted like no bicycles or two bicycles. And that was his rationale for why we shouldn't put in a bike lane.
It's called anecdata.
It is both anecdata, and it's to me, it's the same thing as going out to an area that doesn't have a road and saying, but there's no cars driving on the dirt. So why would we put a road here if there's no cars driving on the dirt? It's because it doesn't work that way.
Yes.
Anyway, Steve, sorry, had to share that.
Yeah. We'll keep you updated on any more developments on a protected bike lane because we know how important they are for a thriving city with an active cycling community. We wanted to cover a few headlines that have happened last week, and we thought we'd start first with the biggest headline of the last week, which was Art Hop. What has happened since we recorded our last podcast? What developments and updates do we have for listeners?
Yeah, last Wednesday, there was a community meeting at City Hall where Councilmember Miguel Arias and Mayor Dyer announced that the city is planning to separate Art Hop into two events. So there will be the art-focused Art Hop, and by art, visual art, performance art that is in official art venues, and the Fresno Arts Council will continue to run that on the first Thursday of the month. And then there will be a separate outdoor street fair that will be on Wednesday evenings. And they're still working out the details on who's going to run the permitting. The intention is to keep it as a free event for vendors to participate in. But that's the direction they're going. At the community meeting, there was a lot of consternation about that change. A lot of people feel like Art Hop was something the community created into the street fair, and now the city is trying to mess it up. But that's the direction we're heading.
Okay. And I've seen, at least online, mixed reactions to this decision to separate. What are you hearing?
Same. I think with the vendors that Juliana on our team has talked to, there's a sadness, certainly, of feeling like it takes a long time to build the type of energy that Art Hop has become. The number has continually been thrown out there that around 15,000 people attend Art Hop each month. You don't get to that from scratch. So there's a fear of if you switch the evening, it's going to mess with people's habits. But there's some happiness that there's going to be more support around safety, and the businesses are certainly happy about the decision because they'll make sure that there aren't food vendors in front of restaurants and things like that.
Okay. Another major headline is some developments around wage theft in Fresno.
Yeah.
What happened this past week?
So the city attorney's office and Councilmember Tyler Maxwell just announced that as part of a new effort, the city has finally launched their website to begin prosecuting wage theft in the city.
And can you define it for us just so we know what we're talking about here?
Yeah. So wage theft is a lot of things, but it's basically if you're not getting paid for wages you're owed in a lot of different ways, you may be a victim of wage theft. And now the city has a website, fresno.gov/wage theft, and they're encouraging people to file their claims there. It's another form of trying to get these issues prosecuted. We know it's expected to be pretty rampant in Fresno and the Central Valley, and they're hoping that more people will come forward with their claims.
All right, next segment, we're going to discuss the recent both county and city ordinances on homelessness. Donnie, can you talk to us a little bit about how we arrived at where we are with some of these ordinances?
So I'll step a few steps back here. So there's been a Supreme Court ruling that came down a few weeks ago. It's called Grants Pass, the Grants Pass decision. And basically what that decision said is that if you're a local government, if you're a city or a county or the state, you can criminalize homeless people who are sleeping in public spaces, or not homeless people who are sleeping in public spaces. And for a lot of local governments, and certainly for the state government, they saw this as a big win in their attempt to, quote unquote, solve the homelessness problem in their respective cities. And so you're seeing a lot of cities and counties across the state of California and across the U.S. now enacting policy to really take the Grants Pass ruling and implement it in their cities. And Supervisor Brandow, Fresno County Supervisor, he did a press conference a little over a week ago announcing that the county has a policy for banning camping in county land for homeless people. The city then, a few days later on Monday, had their own special meeting to actually adopt their own ordinance that does ban camping in public spaces. And so there's a lot of implications for that. Here to talk about this with us is Fresno Land's own housing reporter, Pablo Orihuela. Pablo, we're so glad to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So Pablo, you have been following a lot of these decisions being made by city and county leaders. You were at Monday's meeting that had over 4 hours of public comment. What were you hearing from folks at that meeting?
Oh man, I wish it was only 4 hours. The meeting almost reached the 6 hour mark, which was fun to be at, certainly. Many of the comments ranged from criticisms that the ordinance criminalizes homelessness, questions about who in the homeless community will be affected, if they'll all be affected in the same way, or if the enforcement team will have the chance to make judgment calls on these people, and how can the enforcement team be expected to make these judgment calls, many people which don't have mental health services training.
There was a woman that you highlighted in your story on Monday after the meeting who is a domestic violence survivor. Could you share a little bit more about what her circumstance was and what she was saying at the meeting?
Yeah, so this woman who we chose to hide her identity in our article for protection, she was a victim of domestic violence. She showed up, like many people in this meeting on Monday, with her 3 children. And she said that she is currently living in one of the city's emergency shelters for domestic violence victims. and that shelter only gives her 30 days of residence. It's a standard policy. And when she gets kicked out, she fears that ordinances like this will force her to make a decision, whether to keep on living on the streets and face possible fines and jail time, or to go back to living indoors in a situation that is clearly quite dangerous for her and her children.
And this ordinance, which to our listeners, it went for a first round of approval on Monday. It passed unanimously, 7-0. Every single city council member was in support, in addition to Mayor Dyer. So this ordinance will come back to the council on August 15th and then get implemented a month later in the middle of September. Pablo, what does this ordinance actually do, and what do the penalties look like for people who are found sleeping in a park or another public space?
Yeah, of course. The way the city has announced the ordinance, it looks like it's going to be about three phases in terms of its enforcement. The first being that anybody who is found to be holding a camp out in public spaces, they're going to get a 24-hour notice. That notice will likely be handed out by the HART team, which the city has said will be the lead enforcement team for this ordinance. If that person does not leave and take their personal belongings with them after it was 24 hours, they will likely get a fine of up to $1,000, plus the city says the cost of keeping and storing those belongings.
And the city is required to keep and store their belongings, just so I'm clear.
My understanding is that is a decision they're making.
Where are they going to store these things?
We are still finding that out.
Because you get an array of items at some of these encampments, and correct, like how you would store them safely seems like a pretty good question.
Oh, absolutely. The city's been going fast and furious with their implementation of the ordinance. The county has had a bit more of a robust list of what they consider items to take for these encampments.
But can they take people's personal documents? Do we know that?
It looks like they're allowing them to take it.
They're allowing...
The county's list that they are allowing to take it. The city's ordinance, which has like a ton of strike-throughs, it's very clear that they're still running through it. Going by Councilmember Chavez's comments to add some guidelines for law enforcement to help with judgment calls. But for now, the language just says that they will keep and store personal belongings for up to 60 days.
They're primarily targeting encampments. I'm just picturing there's different kind of manifestations of what homeless can look like or unhoused can look like on the street. Are they targeting the, quote, eyesore elements of homelessness?
So the ordinance's language states that any encampment in a public space, those are the people that will be targeted. And it draws specific attention to sensitive areas. Those areas the ordinance defines as public schools, parks, libraries, community centers, outside shelters for the homeless. Those areas in particular look like they'll be hit first before the ordinance enforcement expands to other parts of the city.
Okay. What about people who are sleeping in their cars? Will they be targeted by the ordinance?
So the ordinance doesn't have language for vehicles yet.
Okay, let's go back to the enforcement for a little bit. Do we expect people to land in jail because of this ordinance?
So city officials have said that the enforcement teams will have some flexibility on how they actually issue the enforcements. By Mayor Dyer's own comments, only the most problematic people, and even some other city officials have said as well, that only the most problematic people that live outside and engage.
Do they define what that means?
The most, by Dyer's own comments, about 80% of the homeless population since his administration has started has had outreach and accepted services and either found permanent housing or gone back to live with family, as well as bettered any sort of substance abuse or mental health issues they've had. But he says that about 20% of the population is considered somewhat problematic. Law enforcement or mental health teams will show out and offer them services, and they simply deny it because they either see it as their legal right to be living outdoors or because they have some sort of mental disability that doesn't put them in the right state of mind to actually help themselves.
Okay, so they get a fine. They can't pay the fine. Then they get a court date of some kind. And then if they don't show up to court, what happens?
Third phase of the ordinance enforcement seems to be that it's a court date where a likely criminal misdemeanor charge will be charged to these people. That can lead up to 1 year in county jail, as well as any fines associated with the court date.
And how much room do we have in the jail at the moment?
By Dyer's own comments during Monday's special meeting, county jail has about 90 to 95% occupancy. So there isn't much room, depending on how many people get sent in jail.
And what about the shelters? Do we have statistics on the capacity of the shelters at the moment? And if that's a viable option.
Yeah, so before the Supreme Court's decision actually went in place, what the Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco said, that the reason why you couldn't enforce these enforcements in the first place was because it was considered cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment to penalize people sleeping outside if you don't have a shelter bed for them. What the Supreme Court decision said was that's no longer an obligation. Local jurisdictions can enforce these ordinances while not having space for them in shelter beds. The mayor said that the shelter bed count is a little over or around 800 at this point, but it sounds like his administration is taking the stance that building more affordable housing so that these people who do get siphoned off into mental health services have a place to live in after they check out is a more viable solution than building a one-to-one count of shelter beds for the homeless population.
That's interesting to hear those comments from the mayor. Affordable housing is something that we're certainly lacking enough of in Fresno and Fresno County, and I know it's come up a lot. And I know that for a lot of unhoused people, homeless people who have mental health challenges, supportive housing is often referred to, which is like a type of affordable housing where there are different types of support services available for people who may not be able to live on their own exactly. And that's often pointed to as a solution. And I noticed, Pablo and I both noticed, that the county's agenda this coming Tuesday has the supportive housing project that the county initially agreed to participate in, and they're pulling out their support because of a lack of funding. And so I think that just raises a question for me. We're going to enact these bans. We're going to say affordable housing is the solution. What are we doing as a city and county to actually build enough affordable housing, and how is that going?
I think what we're doing is we're seeing a passing of the buck, right? We're seeing a city not pursuing the solutions that would help solve this problem by building more affordable housing and passing it off to the criminal justice system.
And that, Jordan, that brings me back to another question I had for you, Pablo, which is that last year we saw Governor Newsom really embrace this new model to supposedly address homelessness called Care Courts. I know you've been doing some reporting, the story hasn't come out yet on Care Courts. Could you explain a little bit about what that is and how the governor and other leaders potentially see that as a solution to some of the most difficult to serve homeless populations?
Yeah, so the new Care Court system, the acronym stands for Community Assistance Recovery and Empowerment Act. And what the CARE Act is supposed to do is pretty much what the city and county want their ordinance enforcement to do here, which is do outreach to people living outdoors who the governor believes that many of them suffer from mental health disabilities or some sort of drug or alcohol addiction, and offer them resources to better themselves. And in the hopes that once the court gives them a plan that they agree to with the local county offices, they can hopefully better themselves and then reintegrate into society and afford housing in wherever they live in.
And that's still being developed locally by the County of Fresno as we speak. And it's my understanding they have to have some sort of care court system in place by the end of 2024. But this ordinance is going to go into effect in September. So what's the bridge between having maybe a more systematic way to address people who have substance abuse issues, mental health disorders, and where we are today?
That's the exact question I'm asking, and will hopefully turn to an article one day by Councilmember Luis Chavez's own comments. He's hoping that the August 15 ordinance, once it gets closer to the fuller realized language, that there could be some sort of guideline for both the HART team and law enforcement and the courts to better decide which of these people should be offered mental health services and which of these people should be directed onto county jail. Only a certain select amount of pilot counties are actually already implementing and running the care courts. Fresno County does not have to implement them until the end of the year. And questions come, which will people that get funneled into these systems between September to December, are they getting a lesser than product? It certainly begs the question whether or not this ordinance should go into effect whenever care courts go into effect. But we'll see once the fuller realized ordinance comes out how the city is deciding how to funnel these people that get contacted by the enforcement outreach team.
This is such a tough issue.
I'm seeing where this is going, which is just processing people into the county jail. And the county jail isn't exactly a place where you go to heal. It's a place, it's a holding pen, essentially, while you're waiting for trial. And we saw and read about a lot of the conditions during COVID in the county jail. Living on the street can be extremely dangerous. There's a lot of health conditions correlated with living on the street, skin issues, extremities issues. People on the street are much more likely to encounter violence, much more likely to be sexually assaulted. There's much more likely to be victims of crimes in general. So obviously, that's not a long-term solution for people.
And some cities and counties are being very aggressive about it. I read an article in the San Francisco Standard today about how Mayor Breed is in San Francisco is allegedly instructing their homelessness outreach team to offer bus tickets out of town prior to offering any other services. That's quite aggressive.
When I lived in Southern California, that was a common thing where homeless people would be taken out of some of the suburban outlying cities and driven right in.
Yeah.
To the center of the city, right into Skid Row, and dropped off where all the services are concentrated. But because they're all concentrated there, that's the kind of environment that's not going to help someone get better.
Right. And you see that to a certain extent here in Fresno County. The city of Clovis doesn't have a homeless shelter. And by all accounts, we've heard direct any unhoused people in Clovis back into Fresno. But yeah, it's a really thorny situation, I feel, for everyone involved.
So one of the ultimate causes of homelessness is the price of housing. And one of the ways that you decrease the price of housing is by building more housing. So there's a project in the northwest of Fresno that's in progress. What's its state?
There's a 82 home apartment complex next to Tatarian Elementary School and Orchid Park in northwest Fresno off of Herndon in the Bluffs-ish neighborhood. And the property was already zoned for multifamily housing. This is like a gated apartment complex. It's all market rate. It's not affordable. It's been in the works for a couple of years. I remember, gosh, back in 2020, 2021, there being some community meetings about this.
What's the holdup?
So the planning department approved it earlier this year, and it got appealed by the neighbors to the planning commission. The planning commission denied it, which was the surprise to a lot of us. And then Mayor Dyer, City Council Member Carbasi, pulled it to the City Council. Then most recently, the City Council denied the project by a 4-3 vote. And Pablo, you've been covering this housing project for the last several months. Tell us, what's the opposition here?
I want to understand the rationale here.
Yeah, so a lot of the opposition has come from neighbors around the surrounding area saying that the proposed projects would change the character of the community.
So that's a pretty stock NIMBY line, which stands for not in my backyard, which is that home values and the character of your neighborhood are the most important aspects of of our communities.
Of course, and a lot of those residents, including their representative in government, Councilmember Mike Carbasi, would push back a bit and say that the residents just want to get a fair shake and to provide their own info on the project. The developer legally had no need to hold any meetings in the neighborhood to discuss the project with the neighboring residents, but they felt, as well as the council member, that meeting should have been held so that the residents can get their input on it. Notably, in the neighborhood, no building, I believe, goes higher than two stories, and the apartment project would have three-story apartments and one four-story apartment on the Herndon side of the development.
So where do we go from here? The council has denied the project. Do we expect a lawsuit from the developer?
When I talked to the developer after the meeting, he very quickly heavily implied that a lawsuit might be in the works. That is his right, as all the council members have said. By Councilmember Luis Chavez's own comments, litigation was expected anyway. Had the council approved the project, going back to even the planning commission hearing, a lot of the residents in the neighborhood were threatening to bring litigation to the city themselves. It seemed like the city was going to face litigation no matter what, and they chose to face it through the developer than through the residents.
And this project is interesting to me for a few reasons. The first being that I don't feel like Fresno has a long history of NIMBYism. And I haven't seen a lot. You hear a lot about a lot of these types of battles in the Bay Area and San Francisco and LA. You don't see them very often in Fresno.
Is that because of sprawl? You can just keep building and so you can run away from
absolutely
the quote unquote problem?
I think part of it is sprawl. Part of it is a lot of the more dense apartment buildings that have been built in Fresno in the past decade or so are mostly in South Fresno neighborhoods where people tend to not fight back as much. There's less than a mile from my house, there's a four-story fully affordable housing project going in. I haven't seen a peep from the neighborhood at all about it. I don't think anyone, I've never seen anything. And the two major projects I'm aware of in North Fresno, both of them are getting fought by the neighborhood pretty hard.
Yeah. I know that home value is a factor, and I know that there's this general, you hear it in passing comments in Fresno when someone describes an apartment building going up in their neighborhood, and kind of you hear this underlying tone to their voice. And at the same time, we want to address this homelessness problem. There's a lot of people that want to have their cake and eat it. And I think at the end of the day, it is a bit of a choice, right? Do we want to increase the housing stock for the city and therefore decrease the price of homes? Seems like we're talking about the problem from two different vantage points, such that people are not seeing the whole.
And I'm sympathetic to neighborhoods changing. I get it. It's hard. If there's a lot that's next to your community for a long time, and there's a certain expectation that nothing is ever going to go there, or a cute little office building is going to go there or something, and then it's something else. I get that. There's a visceral reaction that some people might have. And every academic study that exists on this topic around what happens to your property values when denser housing goes in, what happens to crime when denser housing goes in, like none of that seems to usually support a lot of the fears that people have. And so it goes back to this, Pablo, you mentioned the developer never had meetings with the community, with the residents. Do we think that's going to happen, or are we just now going to plunge into litigation and it's going to go nuclear at this point?
Sounds like the developer has two options. They could go back to the city and offer the project up again as an affordable housing project, where the route to getting approved is much different. I believe it would only need the planning and development department's approval to go ahead and get just the final green light. It wouldn't need to go to council, and there would be no ability by the general public to appeal the project. And the other route is obviously to go through litigation. You mentioned Carbasi and Dyer allowing the appeal in the first place. The reason they did that was because they got advice from the city attorney's office, who said that outright denying this project could lead to a violation of the HAA, mm-hmm. which CalHCD and the attorney general could go ahead and come in for.
So I want to just really fast on that, because I thought that was interesting. There's been a lot of litigation across California and different cities around where cities deny projects like this. They get litigated. They often lose. There was a lawsuit in Berkeley earlier this year where the city of Berkeley had to pay $4 million in fines after they denied a housing project in Berkeley. And so I was surprised, given this background, given what the city attorney had said in previous meetings, that when it came down to the vote, he said he had asked the state whether denying this project would be legal, and he said they never got back to him.
Correct. I believe the legal advice that he gave counsel before the final vote was that they were not sure yet.
That is really interesting legal advice.
We're going to leave it on that note. You can go to fresnoland.org to stay updated on stories and follow-up stories to the things that we've discussed today. So this week, for What We're Loving, we've decided to do an Olympic-themed What We're Loving, because I've been spending my evenings watching people spin on bars and swim in pools. We'll start with Pablo. What's your favorite Olympics event?
Yeah, man, I love all the aquatics. Diving, water polo, swimming. I just think it's one of the most competitive and most appealing to watch for me. I don't even need to know who is in those races. I just love seeing the person that's in the lead fight to maintain the lead. And love to see the people who are behind fight to get it back, and especially people like Kate Ledecky, who are so much better than the competition. It's really impressive to see people like that.
Does that even extend to synchronized swimming? Do you also enjoy that?
Absolutely.
My favorite aquatic event is the synchronized diving. Watch the precision of like how they can mirror each other is incredible. Donnie, what about you? What's your favorite Olympic event?
Come on, gymnastics. Can you... Simone Biles.
Yeah.
She's the GOAT.
Is this her swan song? Is she out after this, you think?
I'm not going to judge, because she continues to prove the haters wrong. Had an amazing comeback after the Tokyo Olympics. she's amazing. And then Suni Lee, like her story, everything about her story, I just love it.
Yeah,
I love
can you share team. A little bit of that? I was blown away by the health issues she went through and being able to come back and
I mean,
get the bronze and all around after that.
It was incredible. She was diagnosed with kidney disease, had to drop out of her elite career at Auburn University, and then really pushed through in the last few years, came back, overcame that, had her own mental health issues, and got the bronze. She's an icon.
For me, my favorite Olympic events is sprinting, anything track related, I absolutely love. There was a Netflix show, I think it was called Sprint, that followed a number of the Olympians that were going to be competing in track. And I just love it because it's just so primal, right? Just, can I beat you in a race? And I just love that there's no frills, there's no nothing. It's just people on a track just trying to run faster than the person next to them. It's so thrilling with 100 meters because it's just so fast. And I don't feel like there's another event where you just have that like anxiety, anticipation in the way you do with Olympic sprinting. So this has been Fresnolandia. Thank you everyone for listening. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. Today's episode was hosted by Jordan and Donnie. Our guest was Pablo Orihuela. We are recording at Sun Stereo Warehouse. It was audio edited and mixed by Jordan Maddox. And our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.